We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, our producer, the guys at the controls this morning, Kyle Mabry, Hour 1. Jason Croft is at the controls right now. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back on the program Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice in our area. She teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And every other month, it's always on a Monday, we talk about women's health. And it is a very open-ended kind of thing. Whatever you think that you might want to talk about, if it's within her area of practice, she will definitely do her best to answer your question. Whenever we have physicians here on the program, I always try to mention that there are some limitations. We cannot diagnose over the phone because the doctor can't see you. But I don't want to discourage people from calling. It's a good place to get some questions asked and answered, and I know that she will try and do that. So what you need to do is just give us a call and ask your question, 333-9455. That's good for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, which is good for anyone listening anywhere. If it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us a question by email right to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
I know that you usually come prepared with a couple things to talk about. So what would you like to talk about?
Well, I thought we could talk about a couple of different subjects having to do with contraception and heavy menstrual bleeding and some of the newer treatments for heavy menstrual bleeding, which also overlap into some of the newer indications for some of the contraceptive methods.
Okay.
So first, I thought I'd talk about a monkey study. I know we usually talk about humans. But this study so intrigued me. So they actually did a weight gain study giving monkeys birth control pills. Thought it was pretty intriguing because most women will tell you that taking birth control pills helps them or hinders their weight loss, i.e.
So they gain weight when they're taking the pill.
Right. And so some researchers in Oregon got the interesting idea to give a group of fairly what I would call fit monkeys. They were fairly fit monkeys, birth control pills. They did it for 9 months, so it wasn't a long study. But actually, that's a pretty terrific study in weight loss realms when people ask me what types of diets they should go on, and I try to quote the diet literature. It's kind of embarrassing to admit that most diet studies can't even make it a whole year because they have so many people kicked out for cheating by the end of the year. But so a 9-month study was actually pretty good in terms of weight loss. And actually, these monkeys did not gain any weight on birth control pills. In fact, statistically, they lost a small amount of weight across the board, and they were fit. And actually, the fit ones lost a little more weight than the heavy ones. So they did say in conclusion that there may be something fundamentally different about people who are overweight, which we know. There's probably something different about their actual fat metabolism, fundamentally different about their we have fat hormones, leptin, can actually be measured on a blood test. So we don't think that it's really the hormone in birth control. We know that when we give women birth control pills, they usually have estrogen and progesterone. We make estrogen and progesterone in our own ovaries, and that estrogen and progesterone that the birth control pill has is actually going to be a lower dose once your own ovary quits making its hormone. You're going to be maintained on a fairly steady and similar, but perhaps even a lower steady state dose than you would have normally. So there is some good biologic plausibility as to why you shouldn't gain weight necessarily being on birth control pills. What I've always told my patients is that for women who are hungrier for whatever reason and eat more, yes, those individuals will seem to gain. But I also have always said that when we do these massive contraceptive studies that I'm sometimes part of, and we have some branches of the study in the U.S. and some branches of the study actually in what's still named third world countries, the branches of the study in third world countries, they do not gain weight there either. A little more similar to the primate literature. May be that their starting body weight was similar. In this particular study, these primates had a body fat percentage somewhere in the 15 to 22%. That's pretty low. It's pretty low. Mm-hmm. David, you're a pretty fit guy, and you probably are in the 15. I bet you're 15%. I wouldn't know, but without doing a real study. But guys tend to run lower. Many of my dieting patients will start out in that 30 to 45 or 50% body fat range when we put them on our body fat machines that are designed to measure that very accurately. And we think that, say, a ballerina might get down to something really, really low, 10, 12% body fat. But most women athletes even are only in that 15 to 20%. And some very fit athletes are in that 20 to 25%. And where we aim for our dieters is usually in that mid-20 range percent. But average American female age 40, say, is probably 28 to 32% body fat. So these were fit primates that they did this study in, but it was pretty interesting because they didn't gain weight on the birth control pill.
So based on this study, the conclusion is that if there are women who are taking the birth control pill and they are gaining weight, if they feel that they're heavier than their ideal weight, or they've gained weight over the time they're on the pill, the study would suggest that it's
not the pill.
It's not the hormones that are they're not playing a right. role in the weight gain.
And that losing and stopping the pill is not going to necessarily turn that around. That other strategies helping women lose weight through other calorie restriction, increasing your activity, changing the type of calories, doing something to increase your metabolism, using the prescription medicines that are available that can reduce your appetite. There are three new medicines came up in front of the FDA in the past, this fall, that were studied in the medicine research, and two failed, but one has made it through committee, will be going up again for the full vote to the FDA board at the end of the month here any day, and hopefully will pass because it got such a resounding recommendation. So hopefully we'll even have a new medication that will be useful for weight reduction come this spring. And I think those medicines can help dieters, whether they're on birth control pills or not, if they're not in their ideal weight range.
Okay. Well, our guest this morning in this hour of focus is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. And every other month she's here. It's always a Monday. We talk about women's health. And if you have questions, give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu.
And the other advances with birth control, so beyond the primate research, has been to tweak the birth control pills. And there have been several developments this fall. And one has been to add folic acid in with contraception. And the Bayer Corporation has taken their Yasmin medication and their Yaz medicine and actually added folic acid to each of those medicines so that in addition to your contraception, you can get the amount of folic acid that you would need if you were planning a pregnancy. So instead of in the morning taking your extra folic acid and taking your birth control pill, you'll get those together. And it's particularly helpful for somebody who perhaps accidentally conceives on the birth control pill and wants to continue that pregnancy, it will significantly reduce birth defects. So, clever.
That seems a little odd, though. I mean, really, doesn't it, to put those two things together?
It does, but it will build up your folate stores so that if you're going to try to get pregnant right after you stop. So, yes, of course.
Well, then let me ask that question as again. And this we're talking about, this is one of the B vitamins?
B vitamins, folic acid.
That's important that women, if they are going to be pregnant, to have a healthy baby, and one of the things you want to make sure that you got your B vitamins. If you were going to start to get pregnant, say you were going to start to try today.
And you're
not on the birth control pill. At what point, say, you would have said, well, really for some time prior to the point where you're actually thinking, okay, now here's the day we're going to start, you would want to make sure that you're getting plenty of...
Well, if you're running the CDC, David, you would be telling everyone from age 15 to 45 that you are in your reproductive years and that all of women from 15 to 45 should be getting the absolute amount of folic acid that we need. And because of that, so many foods now, in addition, are supplemented. So if you have the right kind of diet, you may be getting what you need anyway. In addition, women who have had certain types of birth defects need additional medicine. So as with every piece of advice I've ever said on this radio show, you have to work with your own healthcare provider to make sure that the advice is tailored to your situation particularly. But a few months, 6 months to a year is always ideal for building up one's nutrition stores, but you can probably get it done in a few months.
Okay. We have a caller here, somebody who is on the road, I think, so we'll get right to them here. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. My question is about the implications of pregnancy for women who are maybe around over 30 and HPV positive.
So a couple of different questions. We use the term advanced maternal age over the age of 35. So just over the age of 30, we don't have any special considerations, although we know that at the age of 20, that a risk of having a baby with an extra chromosome number 21, in other words, Down syndrome, is about 1 in 2,000. By the time you get up to age 45, your risk for having a Down syndrome baby is about 1 in 45. So there is a gradual increase in chromosome-related birth defects that does accrue as we get older, but the curve of the graph starts to accelerate as we get beyond the age of 35, and it only creeps up very slowly up to that point. So we've used the term advanced maternal age over the age of 35. In terms of HPV, for anybody that doesn't know, stands for human papilloma virus. That virus is an epithelial virus. It's an outside virus. We don't think, get up into the inside of our bodies. There's been some odd research recently that I've blogged about a little bit, so in case you read some secret writings of mine, but that has associated it with endometriosis. But as far as we know, the human papillomavirus can affect the outside of the vagina, the vulva, the anal area, the rectal area, the vagina itself, the cervix in men, the penis, the urethra in female, the urethra. We think that it may be related to some oral cancers as well. There's some evidence that deeper respiratory or throat cancers could possibly be related. So it can get in those tissues as well. But it is primarily a problem for women of their cervix, vaginal area, vulvar area, in terms of the vast majority of cases. So that with the human papillomavirus, if you just have a positive HPV test and no other abnormalities, it should have no effect on pregnancy whatsoever. If you have had a positive HPV test that has led to an abnormal pap, that has also led to treatment of the cervix, in other words, removing portions of the cervix, then there could be a compromise of the cervix leading to reduced chances of conceiving, reduced chances of carrying the pregnancy, or an abnormal labor. But the treatments that we currently use have minimal statistical risk of infertility, premature labors, or abnormal labor. So we tell women that it's a possibility of a complication, but the statistical risks are extremely small. There's also women who have the type of HPV infection that produce clinical genital warts. If a baby is delivered vaginally when a woman has clinical genital warts, there's apparently a 1 in 10,000 chance that baby will pick that virus up and even have risk of developing the respiratory types of infection. So 1 in 10,000. So it has not been a strategy to recommend C-sections because 1 in 10,000, you'd have to do so many C-sections to prevent one case. So again, we don't think that active genital infections have too much impact on pregnancy, although early in pregnancy, sometimes these infections can bloom because of the change in hormones. I hope that answers the question. It's as fast as I can go on a big topic.
Is the caller still there?
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
We're hoping that we got you a good answer.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Other questions are welcome. Dr. Suzanne Troopin is here. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. Here on the program once every other month, always on a Monday, we talk about women's health, and your questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu.
And one of the other things I might mention, since we were talking about birth control pills, is there's been this question as to whether or not being on a birth control pill would actually increase your risk of picking up HPV disease or increase the risk that HPV disease would progress to a precancerous change or a cancerous change of the cervix. We know that when women are on birth control pills, their cervix actually changes slightly and what we call the transformation zone. So the territory of the outside of the cervix that is a little bit more susceptible to HPV disease actually gets a little bit larger because of the hormones in the birth control pill. So there may be some double truth to the fact that, number one, women aren't as likely to use condoms because they're on the pill, and two, they have this physical change to their cervix. So picking up HPV disease because you're on the birth control pill may be more likely because of these associated factors, not due to the pill itself, but due to secondary factors being on the pill.
Because we're talking about human papillomavirus, has the medical community now gotten to the point where they're recommending that the vaccine, the HPV vaccine, be given to boys?
Yes. So same age group, 9 to 26. And catch-up vaccination, we still feel like the best group to be vaccinated is the group prior to having any sexual encounters. So the younger group, that 9 to 12 group, is the best group. And vaccinating anyone up to age 26, the vaccine prevents acquisition of viruses in the vaccine that you haven't acquired already. It's not going to reverse the acquisition of any viruses that you have acquired. And the Gardasil vaccine protects against 6, 11, 16, and 18, and a couple of cousin viruses. They have some pretty good protection. The Cervavax only protects against 16 and 18. So most of us recommend only the Gardasil vaccine because it has more protection. There are vaccines and clinical trials that have more than just the four. We think there's probably about 30 or 40 different viruses that affect the genital area. So we've got a little work to do to design the perfect vaccine. We can test for some of these vaccines. There is a specific test for the acquisition of HPV virus. So there is a test for 16-18 specifically, and then there's a general test for high-risk viruses. The high-risk test that I use in my office will test for 14 different types of the HPV virus, but there are other tests in development that will test for more. So that's down the line. And we're now looking at strategies as to a couple of different things. Number one, what kind of pap smear strategy should you have once you've had the vaccine? So if you really got it early before you started having sex, do you still need that first pap smear at 21? Do you still need pap smears as often? That will probably change. Number two, how long will this vaccine last you? We're using the figure 5 years as a pretty good solid figure for now, but whether or not you're going to need a booster after 5 years, we're not saying yet. So there will be different strategies that we'll all have to keep paying attention to.
Well, it's supposing that you had somebody, say you had somebody who was upper age limit, so it's like, you know, 25,
mm-hmm.
Someone who had not had the vaccine, someone who had been sexually active and had a couple, at least, of
sure.
sexual partners. And so the recommendation would be, I guess, that that person should be vaccinated.
Yes.
Would you also, though, would it be also recommended that that person be tested just to see what their HPV status at that point is?
Well, no. Yes and no and maybe. Here we go.
Okay.
So we do recommend, FDA does recommend testing women over the age of 30 for okay. HPV virus as part of their cancer screening. And not everybody gets that. It is a little bit of an expensive test. If you have a normal pap smear and a negative HPV test, you have a uterus and ovaries, you need yearly pelvic exams, but you don't always need yearly pap smears. I don't recommend anyone ever give up completely on their pap smears pelvic exams forevermore, but that's a separate topic altogether. Under the age of 30, we do not recommend routine HPV tests because they are so ubiquitously positive. And
you're getting a lot of false positives?
You're going to get a lot of positives.
Oh, okay.
You're going to get a
okay.
lot of positives that you're going to have to chase if you, you know,
oh,
in
okay.
medicine, I always tell my nurses this all the time. I tell my medical students, and I'll tell you too, Dave, if you do a test, if you're going to ignore the answer, don't do the test. And once you get the test, if it's going to be positive, okay. you're going to have to do something with that answer.
You got to be prepared
to act
on your
it.
Test results. Yeah,
right.
Okay.
And one of the problems is that many of those youngsters. Now, I'm going to contradict myself in a second here, so pay close attention to these doctors. They do it all the time to us. But so under the age of 30, you do not want to generally recommend an HPV test for no reason, because many times women will be positive. That test is likely to convert to negative. We predict that of individuals that have a positive HPV test under the age of 30, we predict that 8 or 9 out of 10 individuals will clear. Now, I've spoken to some world experts that say as we get better tests, we're going to prove that nobody clears. Okay, so I warned you. That's our thinking right now. So, no, you don't want to do that. Also, right now, we do these broad range probes. So when we do that probe, we say yes or no, whether you test positive. We don't tell you which viruses completely you test positive for. So we can't tell you whether you test positive to which ones of the viruses that are in the vaccine. Also, there are proprietary tests, like blood tests, that we've used in our research protocols to determine who's developed immunity to certain types of HPV I can't get that test on people clinically. But when we've done those research studies, both with the culture type tests and the blood type tests, we discover that of people who have been sexually active, it's quite rare to encounter individuals that test positive to all four types. It's quite common to run into individuals who test positive to one or more types, but not to all four types. So the vaccine would be less effective for a 25-year-old who tests positive for one or more types, which she is likely to do if she has had a sexual encounter, but it's still likely to be positive. Now, the further question is, okay, now if you're with the partner you're going to have forevermore, and you're not going to ever encounter any other viruses, and nobody's going to bring other viruses into that relationship, do you really need the vaccine? Well, of course, the superficial answer to that question would be no, of course you don't. But the realistic answer to the statistics we know in our country is that other viruses are likely to be brought into that relationship at some point in time, and that vaccination is a good prevention against cervical disease.
Our guest this morning is Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has private practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School. And once every other month, on a Monday, we do these shows. We talk about women's health. And questions are certainly welcome. We're about midway through here. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send along a question by email, you may do that as well. Just write to will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Well, I think you said at the beginning that among the things you wanted, maybe want to talk about was some more about contraception. I guess we've talked about all sorts of things that are related to problems related to menstrual periods,
right?
And treating that with contraceptive. And in some cases, if the problem is having periods, well, you can make it so women have fewer periods. That seems like kind of where we're going on that.
It is. And one of the devices that we've talked about on and off is the Marina IUD. And the Marina IUD in this past year or so, I've lost a little bit of track of exactly when this approval came through, did get approval for the treatment of heavy menstrual bleeding. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that every insurance company out there is going to see the light of that approval, but hopefully they will. But the Marina IUD is a contraceptive device. It's about an inch by an inch wide, but a very skinny device that can sit in a woman's uterus for 5 years, leak a small amount of progesterone-type hormone, and that hormone will provide contraception, does not necessarily prevent ovulation, but that small amount of progesterone hormone will thin out the lining of the uterus so that many women, after an initial period of time where there may be some spot bleeding over the first 1 to 3 months, that lining tissue will thin out so much that heavy menstrual bleeding is significantly decreased, cramping is decreased, actually local endometriosis, swelling may be decreased, and so pelvic pain is decreased. And it's really quite remarkable that this contraceptive method can actually provide a significant amount of gynecologic medical treatments for women. Okay. And it has been compared now as almost a gold standard to some of the newer birth control pills, which are also designed to control heavy menstrual bleeding. And for women who don't want a menstrual period at all or don't foresee having any more children, they can have what's called an endometrial ablation, a NovaSure ablation. Now, a Marina IUD is reversible. A birth control pill is reversible. A completely non-hormonal treatment of heavy menstrual bleeding has also come into the market called Listeda. It's a treatment that we used to use in hemophiliacs when they got dental work to prevent gum bleeding. And that is something that women can take just when they're on their period. And it's non-hormonal and you don't take it all the time. And so that's sort of the competition for that class of treatment. So there are really many alternatives for women who select the surgical NovaSure treatment. They're getting their entire lining burned out, and it's designed for women who don't want more children because the uterus is not really suited for having children anymore, but it's not necessarily an effective contraception. So you either have to stay on your birth control pill, do something like an IUD, or get sterilized, like a tubal ligation, or what's more commonly being combined now are things like the tubal inserts, like the Adiana, the little silicone plugs that can just be put in through the cervix.
So, and for women who want contraception, want something that's reversible, are concerned about the amount of hormones that they're putting in their body. If you decide to go with an IUD like the one you described, is the amount of hormone that then you're putting into the, is that actually less than with the oral contraceptive?
It is. Probably about a third the amount of the progesterone as in some pills. May only be a half amount of the progesterone, but it has no estrogen, so it can be used in women who aren't candidates for using estrogen. And for most women, they don't get any systemic effect of their hormone at all. It's all just local effect. A few women will get systemic reactions like the acne or some other side effects. But for most women with marine IUDs, they get no systemic effect of hormone whatsoever.
Okay. We have a caller, an email here from someone who would like you please to talk a little bit about the pros and cons of taking Fosamax.
So Fosamax is a bisphosphonate. It is a treatment for the prevention or the treatment of osteoporosis. And there are many bisphosphonates now in the class that we have available. So Fosamax being the first that came on the market, and it's available as a once-a-month formulation. It's also available now as generic, so preferentially on many insurance companies. It's competition. Actonel is available as either a once-a-month formulation, a once-a-week formulation, and now Actonel, the resigenating molecule, came out just very recently with a competitor. It's the same molecule that you can actually take with food, and I'll get back to that in a second. And also in this bisphosphonate class of medicine is a once a month or a four times a year IV called Beneva. There's also in this same class of medicine another bisphosphonate called Reclast that's only dosed intravenously once a year. So there are quite a few competitors in this class. We use the criteria of either having osteoporosis. So if you've had an x-ray and you actually have an osteoporotic fracture, that is a diagnosis of osteoporosis. Or if you've had a bone density test and you have a bone density that shows osteoporosis, then you are in a category that needs treatment for this condition. Also, women who have osteopenia with significant risk factors, so low bone mass with significant risk factors. And for those women who want to see if they have significant risk factors, the World Health Organization, in conjunction with the National Osteoporosis Foundation, has come up with a kind of a little tool to help you calculate where you are. And it's called the FRAX score, F-R-A-X. And you can go to nof.org and go into the risk the FRAX tool, and it takes a little bit, and you have to work with it a little bit because it's all in instead of pounds, you have to use kilograms. You got to convert some numbers. It's probably the easiest to do with your healthcare provider, and if you actually know your bone density, makes it a little bit more accurate. But at any rate, we now use what we call fracture prediction. So that if your score is such, but you're young, you're 50, you're going to be less likely to be a candidate for medicine than someone with that same score who's older, with the thinking being that older individuals are a little bit more likely to be frailer and actually more likely to fall. So they factor in some of those kinds of things before we recommend treatment for those only in low bone mass. But everybody who has osteoporosis is a potential candidate for treatment. In addition to the bisphosphonate class, there's a competitor now called Prolia that's in a completely different class of medicine. And also for those in very high risk for fracture, there's parathyroid hormone treatment or Forteo. So it's kind of a big topic. With bisphosphonates, Fosamax has been around the longest. There's the most data for it. It probably has the most robust hip fracture data out there from its original formulation. Many women now are getting the generic, which may be a little bit of a problem. Bisphosphonates are not well absorbed. Only 1% of the drug is absorbed. So if you don't take your medication right or you skip doses, you're really at risk for not bothering to take your medicine at all. It's kind of a problem medicine. Fosamax also happens to have the longest half-life, so that once you've been on it for 5 years or for 10 years, there's some thought that women should take a little break so that their bone metabolism turnover can kind of wake back up, because healthy bones have to turn over. And that's one of our sort of research questions that's going on right now. Actonel in particular has much faster turnover, and so some physicians favor that. And this new molecule of actonel, the new resigernate, actually gets absorbed in the intestinal tract, so that you can actually take it with food, and your food is in your stomach. This thing gets absorbed in your intestine, so you can get your 1% absorption, even though you're taking it with food, as long as you get your water with it. So that's, we think, a big plus. Those formulas, but the new one actually is a once a week. Some people say that if you only have to take it once a month, it's easier. Some people say if you only have to take it once a month, but you skip the once a month, then you're skipping a lot of your percentage of medicine. So that's been a controversy. That's why the reclass that only goes in intravenously and then it's in your body, boom, actually in some studies outperformed anything oral because it's in there. So there's good evidence that these medicines make your bones healthier. They improve the structure. They prevent fractures in all the research trials. They probably reduce fractures in the ranges of about 35 to 55, 60%, depending on the part of your body in the study you look at and how long of a study it is. So they're all good in that respect. They are all well covered by most insurance companies. And at some point, you live long enough, most of us are going to get into a fragile bone situation that is going to benefit in terms of fracture prevention by being on something. And what is convenient to take and covered by your insurance and has a low risk profile in terms of your own health is probably going to be the best way to go.
Yeah. I know for a lot of women, the gastric problems associated with Fosamax particularly are a real problem. And I'm sure it's complicated by the fact that the advice is you're supposed to take it on an empty stomach.
Right.
But it sounds as if maybe this other medicine, this newer medicine, might be a way around that.
It is. And that's where the intravenous ones, even the intravenous products actually have some gastric upset with them. Who knows exactly how that mechanism works exactly. But that was the impetus for some of them to be intravenous. And this new Prolia is a sub-Q. It's twice a year. So it lasts for 6 months. You come back in 6 months, you get another little injection that just goes pop and it's right in. It's done. And so that's important. But with the intravenous and the sub-Q, you really have to be good about your calcium over the next, I always say, 2 weeks. Some people, some doctors will say a month, because that will just suck your calcium out of your bloodstream. If you're not good about your calcium, you've got that big dose of medicine in you. So that's important.
And what's now, also, there has been a lot of publicity about some women taking bisphosphonate having serious problems with bone loss in their jaw.
Well, there is an entity called osteonecrosis of the jaw. people with dental problems are more likely to get it. People with cancers or certain kidney diseases are more likely to get it. People having extensive dental work are more likely to get it. I've seen figures as rare as 1 in 10,000. I've seen figures as high as 3 to 6%. I myself have never really seen a case of it. When I've been on review panels and reviewed some data, there's some question as to how you make that firm diagnosis. Some just say if you have a little bit of your gum line pulled down with a little bit of extra exposed bone that you would normally not have, they were making that diagnosis of osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is how they got to the figures as high as 3 to 6% of the population. So there is a warning that all those medicines could be associated with that problem, but it's quite rare. They're also now seeing some people on bisphosphonates. They've reported about 300 cases where in the long bone of the leg, the femur, with atypical fractures. These fractures occur in people not on these medicines altogether. So it's something that does happen, but they worry that with some people on these medicines for long periods of time, if their bone turnover was slow, they get odd fractures that shouldn't occur. So that is another warning. Basically, you have an odd pain, get it checked out because you may have one of these atypical fractures. Again, not something I've ever diagnosed, and I've prescribed a lot of these medicines, but we have so many people, particularly elderly people or particularly people who have fallen on these medicines, we're going to see some of these complications.
Why? It just seems strange that a medicine that the purpose of which is to prevent bone loss would actually have the effect of, in some people, in some places, actually promoting or accelerating bone loss?
Most likely, our measurements of bone health are too crude. So that when we do a bone density, so what we really want to know is how good is your bone? How strong is your bone? And we're measuring the dimensions of it, saying that thicker is stronger, which it is for most people, but we're not measuring the flexibility. So your bone can't be too wobbly, or that's not a good thing, and it can't be too brittle, and we're not measuring that flexibility. And we need to look at that structure so that if we had a ladder and that ladder was made of wood and we left it out accidentally all winter and we went to use it and there were a couple of chinks of wood out of that ladder, but it happened to be in places not where the struts abutted against the side pieces of the ladder, we could probably use that ladder pretty safely. But if the one place that it had lost wood was a place where one of those struts had come into the side piece, and it, therefore, when you step with your foot, that side piece is not strong, well, you're going to have a break. So it's probably more complicated than I'm explaining, but we don't have a good functional way of measuring our bone structure, our integrity. They do that in research studies with biopsies, but we don't have a way of doing that clinically.
We have maybe about 5 minutes left, 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. Dr. Suzanne Troopen is here. She's an OBGYN used to be once a month. Every other month now she's here on the show, and we talk about women's health. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something else that you want to talk about?
One of the things I was going to mention is thyroid levels. I often have gotten calls over the years about measuring one's thyroid and the accuracy of measuring one's thyroid, and individuals who may feel that their thyroid levels don't reflect the accuracy of their blood tests. And I know over the years we've actually changed how we interpret thyroid levels, and they're doing it again to us. And it's kind of interesting. There have been some research studies specifically having to do with pregnancy and with miscarriages, and specifically looking at individuals who have had miscarriages and looking at their thyroid levels. And indeed, individuals with thyroid levels that are normal but slightly higher than patients who haven't miscarried make certain researchers think that we need to be using a more stringent cutoff for some women for normal thyroid levels in early pregnancy. It hasn't reached the point where this is a general recommendation, but for somebody who has maybe had more than one miscarriage, it may be something important to look at this new research and maybe tighten their thyroid levels down, may or may not prevent another miscarriage, but it's pretty interesting research, and it's available out there on the internet. Somebody's doctor wanted to search it out and know what levels they're going after. We're also starting to use thyroid-binding globulin, so antibody tests to search out. Maybe in some of these women, they have odd antibody levels that are really the culprit, and that if you supplement with thyroid, you can get those antibody levels to settle down, and that would be why the miscarriages are prevented.
Let me ask you about something else that's just been in the news here, and I'm sure we talked about it, but maybe not in a long time, and that is breastfeeding. Just recently, the Surgeon General, I imagine, the Surgeon General apparently thinks it would be good to encourage more women to breastfeed and breastfeed for longer, because obviously there are obvious health benefits for the babies as well, and as well as the fact that they argue that it can actually save you some money that you would be spending on formula, that you're now spending on formula. That really gets to this question, well, if there aren't that many women breastfeeding, or maybe the issue is that apparently there are a lot of women who start, but they don't.
Right.
Very quickly, the numbers who are breastfeeding sort of start dropping off. So you wonder, well, what exactly is the issue here? Is that women are not being encouraged to do it, or is it that because of the way we live, it's difficult to be able to do? What do you think are the issues?
Well, I want to give a little shout out to my patients because I think they're doing a really good job of starting breastfeeding. And in the many years that I've been in practice, I feel like we've done a good job of in the hospital encouraging patients to breastfeed. We've had great lactation counselors in our community, and I do think we're doing a better job of getting women educated, encouraging more women to try it, encouraging more women to stick with breastfeeding for longer periods of time. I think we get the message out there that it uses calories, it's good for baby's nutrition, it's good for their mouth and speech development, and that everybody should be breastfeeding as long as possible. I do think that the realities of getting back to work, and it's pretty common for moms to get back to work after that 6 or 8 weeks off, I think probably is what I see as the biggest challenge. I think getting dads involved, and what I see is moms saying, well, yes, I understand about the breast milk business, but I want dad to be involved in some of those night feedings, so I'm putting milk in a bottle so that dad can get up with babe. And babies haven't changed a lot. They haven't evolved. And some babies are really good about that back and forth with bottle versus breast, and some babies just aren't. And I just think it's a real easy leap from breast milk in a bottle to formula in a bottle. I mean, and that's just what I see in my patients. But the support is out there. Maybe the messages aren't out there as much. I still think that new moms, it's just easier if you see there's X number of ounces in a bottle, and then the bottle's empty and it went into that baby. That's how much the baby got. And when the baby's just kind of hanging out on the nipple, and you have to just kind of see if the diaper was wet and you're a new mom, I get a lot of feedback that that's just a less secure feeling. And or if you have to say, well, weigh the baby in a month when you come back for the checkup. That's just to see if baby is growing. So I just think that in our society, the way we like to know things, we've gotten down to this, those books where you have to know everything about everything, and you can read a label on formula, and it's just, moms don't come with those labels.
So the important thing is the milk and what's in it. So pumping it and then putting it in a bottle and then giving in the bottle, aside from the fact that the baby might say at one point, say, what is this bottle thing or what is this? I mean, do they get to so that they then will drink from the bottle, but then when they're presented with the breast, they say, what's this? Or
well, to some extent, because the breast, you have to work at getting the milk out of a breast versus a bottle. Just kind of, they have redesigned those bottles. They are better than they were. But also for jaw development, working at getting milk out of a breast is better. Work is better. Kind of like doing, you know, weightlifting with a 10-pounder instead of a 1-pound weight. It's better. So I think that there are just many factors that have led us to say that our breastfeeding strategies could be better. And talking to the new moms is probably better than talking to the obstetricians and midwives. But I still, in comparing to 10 years ago and 20 years ago, and we won't say how much longer than that ago, but I still think that moms are doing a better job around here.
Well, there, I think we'll finish up. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. Her practice is the Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She also teaches at U of I Med School. Every other month, she's here. We talk about women's health. Thank you very much.
Thanks.